Transitioning to a decarbonised economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organisation and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
Deep inside a cave, the air smells of rock and carbon and time. An ancient ancestor is looking at the wall. They press their hand against it hard, fingers splayed, the flickering shadows giving the wall depth and movement. And then there appears a rust-red, pigment-blown outline of the hand. And then another, and another, and another. Our ancestor is marking time. Human and geological timelines intersecting for a moment. Jump forward to ancient Egypt, the sun beating down on the roof of a workshop. Time itself beaten out by the metronome of a hammer against stone. And then out comes the revered pigment maker, brandishing bowls filled with a coloured powder. Not the ochres and the browns and the yellows of the earth, but this time, for the first time, the bright blue of the summer sky, the blue of the life-giving Nile, the blue of the divine. A blue never captured like this before. In an instant, we're in an attic room. Victorian London, a young chemist is staring at his test tube. He's been trying to create a synthetic quinine, a clear liquid, and yet something's happened. He's made a vibrant purple sludge by mistake. And then he has an idea that will change the world. Hello and welcome to Patented, a podcast about the history of inventions with me, Dallas Campbell. Today, it's all about colours. We have been transfixed by colours in all kinds of ways since the beginning of time. And as a species, we've embarked on a never-ending quest to invent, to conjure up new colours, brighter pigments, better dyes. My guest today is Cassia St. Clair. She's the author of a terrific book called The Secret Lives of Colours. Something about our love of colour and our desire to be able to make and use it and celebrate them in different ways. It's very interesting and very powerful. I think so anyway, and I think you will too. Hope you enjoy the show. Cassia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's lovely to have you. I love your book. Your book is elegant, it's beautiful, it's beautifully written, it's fascinating. Who knew there were so many stories attached to colours? I've been thinking about how to talk about it, because obviously we're a podcast about inventions, and I'm going to say something like, who invented colour? And you're going to say, no one invented colour. But people not invent colour, but they invented ways of making colour, I suppose, different manufacturing techniques and things like that. I want to start just by asking you why colours are so important. Why, for us as a species, like, I can understand if you're a bee, like colour, yeah, need colour. Don't bees see in like infrared or something, or ultra something?
Well, yeah, actually our colour vision, while it's, you know, better than that of dogs, for example, it isn't the best in the animal kingdom by any stretch of the imagination.
And yet we're obsessed by colour. We are. We bloody love it. We ruddy love it.
Yes, and finding great sources of colour, particularly very vibrant, saturated colours, has really been kind of a human preoccupation. We have traded for better sources of colours. We have conquered countries. We have participated in industrial espionage. We've done all sorts of things to get our hands on better sources of brighter colours.
I like that idea of like we've invaded countries because we want their purple. Like they have purple. We don't have purple in our country.
Not as bright purple. We need better purple.
Which country have we... Who's invaded who? Wait, who? What?
So if you look at, particularly in the Roman era, places that had brilliant sources of different minerals that were used for colours were kind of highly prized, even if they had really not much else to offer. Minerals like cinnabar, for example, from which you could get vermilion. Places that had naturally occurring great sources of cinnabar were taken over and then became really important to the Roman Empire. And in fact, you know, in the case of cinnabar, this was transported under guard to Rome. So highly prized was this colour.
And why do we... Okay. This is, I'm going to ask you some really dumb questions. These colours are for what? For painters or for dyeing fabrics or for...
All sorts of uses, really. So, you know, the very earliest traces of colour use, you know, if you think about cave art, for example, we were using it to create patterns and illustrations and to kind of document the world around us in our living spaces. Why exactly that was done is mysterious. It's lost to time. Was it just because we wanted, was there a religious reason? Was it because we wanted decoration or was it something to do? We're not entirely sure. But, you know, for Romans and cultures that came thereafter, they put colour to a lot of uses. Yes, it was used for dyes that could, you know, determine different social strata. It might be for religious purposes and it might just be for decoration and to colour artefacts, that kind of thing.
It is, and you talk a lot about that book actually, about how... you know, certain colours are to do with royalty, for example, or there's certain colours that we see in religious iconography, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to come into that in a moment. You mentioned something which just then about cave art. I think that maybe that's quite a good place to start. The other day, I was in the White Desert in Egypt, and I went into a cave called the Cave of the Swimmers, I think it was called, and in it... there are loads of handprints all over the cave wall. Not like someone's put their hand in the paint and just splotted it, but it's kind of blown. So you get the, you know, the outline of the hand. I noticed all the colours were kind of reds and browns and sort of rust kind of colours. And that, when I think of sort of Neolithic art like that, you don't see ultramarine and purple. You just see those sorts of earthy colours that are kind of reflected in the landscape, I suppose. And I just wondered what artists back in the Neolithic times were thinking about and how they would make colours and what they would think of colours.
So the colours they use predominantly, the colours that you see on cave walls, are the colours that kind of occur most naturally and that they would have found around them. So in the cases of those reds, they're basically what we would call red ochres or hematite.
What's it called? Hematite.
Hematite, yeah, which is kind of with a lot of colour terminology, there's lots of kind of overlapping terms, but sort of broadly speaking, you can, you know, use the word hematite to refer to kind of a broad family of pigments that are red, and they sort of borrow their red from kind of rusty colours from, you know, iron oxides that stain the earth, basically. And you can find naturally occurring deposits of usually quite rich red pigments in different parts of the world. It's fairly common.
Mars. If you're a Martian, you're going to love Neolithic art.
Well, maybe your caves are red and then the red wouldn't show up so well. You'd need another colour to show up against the red. On Earth, you know, there are lots of deposits of kind of red earth that are iron oxide rich. They sort of were really widely used. So, you know, quite often you find red earth pigments were sprinkled in burials. They were used to dye cloth or to colour cloth. And, you know, the use of red ochre has been sort of decreed as one of the defining attributes of kind of developing consciousness and mankind, along with
really,
you know, use of tools. Yeah.
Interesting. Why would colour sort of influence the cognitive development, do you think?
We don't know exactly the relationship with cognitive development, but archaeologists who look at this period see the use of the development of tools and the use of red ochre are sort of coming in at the same time. And some archaeologists have given kind of equal weight to both and say this is part of the development of cultures and societies, and, you know, the formative development of cultures and societies. And what's so fascinating is that you see it kind of the world over. Different cultures in very different places in the world are making use of red pigments that they find around them, you know, to decorate their spaces, to decorate the things they create, to sprinkle over graves, and so on and so forth. And so this use of colour is clearly very important to them.
And presumably, I don't know, presumably the fact that these, as you say, these are colours that are kind of reflected in the landscape, that idea of being connected to the landscape is important in such civilizations.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to know. Looking at it now, you think that that must be something that's very important, because it's something that's so striking looking at that art, is that how the colours reflect the landscape around them. But then it's sort of a chicken and egg question, which came first, the fact that most of the pigments came from the landscape, or was it the fact that the landscape is so important and therefore they choose those colours? I mean, you also see a lot of black pigments that come from the soot of fires, for example. So yes, you do get, you know, black colours in landscapes, but then this is an artificial colour, as in it's coming from the embers of fires.
I'm going to talk about black in a bit, actually. We'll come to black in a bit, because I want to talk about Vantablack. We did an episode about Vantablack, by the way. If you don't know what Vantablack... Well, Cassie, you know what Vantablack is. Listeners,
oh, trust me, I know.
Yeah, I know you. I have some Vantablack in my house ages ago. They sent me a sample.
Oh, absolutely fantastic. I mean, mind-blowing.
Mind-blowing. But actually, you mentioned sort of soot. Soot is really black. Soot is as black as Vantablack, I'm pretty sure.
Not quite, but I mean, it is really black. I was watching a fascinating video on Twitter the other day of how Japanese ink is created, and they use kind of soot often to pigment this special kind of ink that they use. And the sort of very painstaking process, which has actually been in use for thousands of years, you know, the collecting of soot, the burning of kind of special candles or little fires, you then collect the soot. And there's wonderful stories of soot being collected with feathers, so they get every last little drop of this precious soot in order to make, you know, beautiful soot black pigments.
This is the thing that's interesting to me, is these extraordinary technologies that we develop in order to get colour. So if we call our sort of hematite and black pigments that we get from the earth as sort of colour number one, I suppose. I mean, how did the Neolithic civilizations, how would they have got the hematite? Like, if I want to do one of those handprints on the wall using my paint, how am I going to make it? Is it just kind of grinding up rock? Or am I adding stuff to it? Or what's
it? It's grinding it up, and then it's mixing it with some kind of, depending on your on the way you're going to use it, you might want it to be a liquid. So if you're going to be, you know, for example, blowing it through a tube, you might not want it to be too dry. You might want it to have a little bit of a liquid binding agent. You know, that might be water, something as simple as water, but it might be something a little bit more complicated, a binding agent. And obviously binding agents have continued to evolve. And now we use kind of like, you know, liquid, semi-liquid plastics and things like that. But, you know, really that's as simple as it is. You want something, you know, a colorant, and you want a binding agent. And then the world is your canvas and you can do whatever it is you want to do.
And what's amazing is those handprints, they've been there for like thousands of years without, I mean, obviously they're in a cave, they're in the dark, but there's still light that gets in. And the fact that they haven't faded to nothing and that they're still there is, to me, is just sort of mind-blowing.
Mm. Well, I think some of these, you know, some of these very early pigments that we might think of, and perhaps they even thought of as very basic, and would later on be replaced by more complicated pigments that were perhaps brighter, but more fugitive. They were more prone to disappearing when exposed to bright light or over time. And actually some of these, you know, simple earth pigments are incredibly reliable, are incredibly long lasting, and where the more modern, brighter, flashier pigments maybe fade over time, these ones are incredibly reliable, and many of them are still in use. You know, we still use ochres, we still use red ochre and yellow ochre, and we still use soot blacks, and we still use chalk whites. These are still very important pigments. They're naturally occurring, and they've been with us, you know, from the dawn of time. They were there way before we arrived, and they will be there after we leave.
Let's talk. Okay, let's sort of move in. Actually, while I'm in Egypt, let's jump from the Neolithics through to the 18th dynasty. You go into sort of somewhere like sort of Tutankhamun's tomb, or any sort of royal tomb in Egypt or something, and you know you can see this wonderful color palette of blues and golds and everything else. Can we sort of move a bit? Like, how did we start, beyond just sort of grinding up rocks, how did we start to kind of really manufacture colours that were beyond nature, if you see what I mean.
Well, I guess the history of the human relationship with colour is a lot about desire. We want access to beautiful colours, and where we can't get them easily, where they're too expensive, where they have to travel too far, where the trade routes get disrupted, we want to create something that's more stable, that we have more access to, better access to. And so that's why we start trying to, human beings start trying to create more stable access to brighter colours. And with the Egyptians, probably, you know, the best example is Egyptian blue, which is this, you know, wonderful bright pigment that they used. And you can see it a lot on little sculptures that they made in tombs. They used it to draw hieroglyphs. It was kind of a really kind of multi-use color that they loved. It was very important in their culture. It represented the sky and the Nile, which was, you know, incredibly important for their culture because of the growing season, and also their deities. Some of their deities kind of had this blue aspect to them, which was important kind of for religious reasons as well. So they wanted to create a blue pigment. And while they had access to other blues, for example, lapis lazuli, these blues were problematic for one reason or another. They were either very scarce or very expensive or very difficult to use. But because they wanted a really wonderful, useful, and easy to use blue pigment, that kind of led to the creation of Egyptian blue, which is something that they made artificially. They had to find a source of copper, which was usually like the malachite, and then they would mix that with sand. It would then be fired at very high temperatures, and then the resulting kind of glassy product, which was this mixture of the copper and the silica from the sand, would then be ground again, and then again heated to very high temperatures. This was quite a complicated process.
Yeah.
Not only did the temperatures have to be quite exact, the first temperature is around 900 to 1000 degrees, and the second firing is around 800 degrees, but the levels of oxygen have to be relatively precise as well. So, you know, it's a difficult blue to create, and yet they made an awful lot of it, and they made great use of it once they had made it.
How on earth did someone figure that out? Like, how on earth, like, right, we need some kind of blue, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to get some copper, and I'm going to do this precise thing, and then I'm going to do something. I mean, the sort of chemistry involved, or the knowledge involved in doing something like that, is immense.
I mean, the truth of almost all these things, I often think about this when I'm making a cake or making bread. You know, the truth is there must have been some sort of kind of accident.
Sort of George's Marvelous Medicine kind of thing.
But I mean, exactly who it was that first stumbled upon this quite complicated process, we don't know. But actually there's a very new blue, you know, now in the past 5 years, a very new blue was discovered, again completely by accident, by a chemist.
It's a really interesting, the language here is really interesting, the idea that you can discover a color. You know, when you're a kid and you go, oh, let's try and invent a new color, and you can't think of a new color because it's not like you go, oh, look, there's a color over there I've never seen before. Or it, when you say invent, you mean like getting a new technique of producing a colour that we already know exists?
Well, we might already know about it. We might have a name for it, but the qualities might be very different. So
right,
when you talk about a colour, are you talking just about the, you know, the kind of the chroma value? Is it just a very bright blue, which you could possibly get from using another, you know, another set of ingredients? But then you've also, particularly if you're an artist, you might think about how opaque that colour is. You know,
yes,
when you put it on a very dark background, for example, can you see the dark background through it, or does it stand out because it's very opaque? You know, there are all sorts of things that go into the making of a wonderful color. And quite often artists, when you talk to them about, you know, their favorite colors, they might mention something like the texture. How buttery a paint is will be really important to them, and how it plays with the other colors that they like using. And so things that you might not think of immediately as being very important to a color have great importance for people in different uses.
That's really interesting. And that idea of favourite colour is another sort of kid thing. It's like we like to discuss our favourite colours. Just whilst we're in Egypt, and then I'll move away from Egypt. I don't mean to be an Egypt bore, but that idea of Egyptian blue is really interesting. I did a programme about Tutankhamun, and I was kind of going through some of Tutankhamun's kit, some of his stuff, and I didn't find anything, but that's another story. There was a paint box, like a really kind of modern looking paint box, you know, like when you're a kid and you get little squares of watercolors and a little brush in the middle of the tin and you open the tin, kind of one of those, but a little bit different. And all the paints were kind of unused, some of them had some use apart from one. And it was that blue. It was a blue, and it had been used like loads because it was like a hole in it. You could see where it had been worn away. So it was like you could look at that and go, well, he obviously liked blue. That was his thing.
How fabulous. What a wonderful sort of, you know, view into a life. It's slightly off the topic of colour, but my sort of favourite thing that was found in Tutankhamun's tomb was a faux leopard skin, which was made out of linen, and the leopard spots were appliqued on. They were sort of sewn on patches.
That's nice. Okay, so you mentioned lapis lazuli, which is, well, we're on the subject of blue. So we've gone from heating up copper. So lapis lazuli, just remind us what that is and how we use that as a pigment.
Yeah, so it's a semi-precious stone. You probably have seen it in jewellery, you know, in earrings or necklaces. It's this beautiful blue stone that looks a little bit like the night sky. The base is this wonderful dark blue colour, and then you quite often see little speckles of what looks like gold, but in fact isn't gold, it's fool's gold, it's iron pyrite. And then you also see what look a little bit like clouds, which are these kind of white occlusions in the stone. And the blue ground itself, which is what artists really highly prized and was, you know, known as ultramarine, this wonderful, bright, you know, rich blue pigment that was beloved by Renaissance artists, that has to be extracted from lapis lazuli. You have to get rid of all those little speckles of gold and the white occlusions, and you have to just be left with the blue. And that was an incredibly difficult process. Firstly, because the best sources of lapis lazuli were not conveniently located right outside Venice, where, you know, lots of the Renaissance artists were working. They were located in, you know, very remote regions of Afghanistan. So the, you know, big chunks of lapis lazuli stone would be brought up from the mines, and they would be traded all over. But for artists who really wanted to extract the blue, they would have to get hold of chunks of rock, and they would then need to grind it down to a powder. The powder itself is really disappointing. It's kind of quite greyish looking. And so you need to purify it to remove the blue. And that process is tricky. What you need to do is mix the ground up, rather disappointing looking greyish powder with something like a mastic or a wax. And then you then need to knead this, rather like you might knead a bread dough, in a solution of lye. And as you knead it, the blue part of lapis lazuli sort of falls into the solution of lye and settles at the bottom. You can then tip off the lye solution, and you're left with, you know, the powdered ultramarine that you can then mix with the binding agent and use as a paint.
And so, it's such a great, I've always loved that word, ultramarine. It's not just marine, it's ultramarine, supermarine.
It actually means beyond the sea. Ultra and mare, that's the two words, beyond the sea. So even somewhere, just in the word itself,
beyond the sea,
you get this, you get the sense of how far the pigment has had to come and how precious and special it is.
That's lovely. And so because it's so precious and special and expensive and difficult to manufacture, who would be using it? Sort of politically, who would be using ultramarine and these, only the greatest artists, presumably, or the finest clothes makers? Or,
well, I mean, particularly in the Renaissance, you know, it's not just about the artist, it's about the patron. So the patrons would want the works of art that they were commissioning to contain ultramarine because it was so precious and rare and expensive and beautiful. And so, you know, if you're being very generous, you would say it reflected their devotion. If it's a religious piece of art, their love of religion, their love of their God, their love of the Virgin Mary or whoever it was that the work of art is depicting. But you might also say that it's kind of a vanity thing. You are showing by your liberal use of ultramarine how rich you are.
A little bit blingy. Bit kind of
you know, there is a sort of a bling element to ultramarine, particularly to works of art that use an awful lot of it, because you are showing the world that this is an incredibly expensive work of art, and you have spent a lot of money to create it. And, you know, patrons often specified how much of the canvas that they wanted to be covered in ultramarine. There are contracts that specify how much ultramarine should be used, and patrons who might really distrust the artist might procure the lapis lazuli themselves and then might dole it out to the artist on a kind of day-by-day basis to try and ensure that they're not being duped, that the artist isn't going to use a cheaper blue pigment and kind of either make money off selling the ultramarine or use the ultramarine on kind of pet projects that aren't the patrons.
It's really interesting that, because, okay, I want to sort of move on and talk about the kind of invention of sort of synthetic dyes. Do colours still have that sort of resonance? I mean, you know, middle class people nip over to Farrow and Bull to get their Farrow and Bull, and they can have kind of any colour they want with their little, you know, you take your swatch of whatever and Farrow and Bull do it in 2 minutes. Do we still have that kind of relationship with colour, do you think?
I think it's different. You know, it changes over time. So there's, you know, with all these things, there's fashion involved. So the colour trends change over time. But you do get some colours that just signal wealth. And the example that I like to use most often is if I see someone walking around London with a white coat on during the winter, I know that that signals a certain degree of wealth, particularly if it's kind of a very fine, you know, woolen white coat, because you are not taking the tube with a white coat and looking as great when at the other end of the journey as you know, you do at the start, because white is a very difficult color to keep clean. And so having an awful lot of very delicate stain showing colors, that's very difficult to keep clean. It's very difficult to keep looking fresh. And so that signals a certain type of wealth, that you are prepared to buy clothing that is delicate, that's expensive, and that is white and that is going to show stains, you know, immediately.
We'll be back after this short break.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and this month on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm dusting down my magnifying glass to investigate some of history's most notorious murders and brutal crimes. Was Amy Dudley pushed down a flight of stairs to her death? Was it a quarrel, or was the brilliant playwright Christopher Marlowe actually murdered? And what's the truth about the Hungarian noblewoman who allegedly killed hundreds of young women? Join me for Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts, or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
Let's talk about the invention of synthetics. We've talked a lot about, you know, natural products, if you like. And actually, the one thing we haven't mentioned is animals. I mean, the fact that we get colour from beetles as well, particular colour, is quite interesting. Very briefly, which beetles do we get which colours from? And then I want to move on to synthetic.
Yeah. So the most famous one is cochineal. So this is
cochineal. That's the one. Yes. It's red, isn't it? It's a red colour.
Yeah. It's a very, very, very small bug that, you know, that there's a kind of a family of them, and some are native to Europe, but cochineal is most famously native to kind of Central America. And basically it feeds on a very particular kind of cactus, prickly pear, and it has to be kind of spread onto new leaves. And this was done.
What a faff.
A real faff. But this was done by Aztecs and Inca civilizations using a fox fur brush.
Man, see, that's hipster taking hipster stuff too far. Can you imagine, it's like, oh, sorry, those leaves aren't new enough? Actually, and that's not a fox, that's a raccoon. We need fox.
Not good enough. Not good enough for cochineal. Because it's a really, you know, it's very precious. You know, once leaves are infected, they kind of grow this, it looks like a bloom, to be honest. You know, they're so small. There was quite a lot of arguments about whether they were in fact beetles, or were they in fact grains or bits of pollen. You know, no one was quite sure. But what it looks like is a kind of a white bloom on the leaves. And when you kind of scrape this off and squish it, you get this kind of bright red, jammy substance, of which is squished bug, and this is a very, very precious dye, and it, you know, it takes a lot, an awful lot of beetles and an awful lot of leaves to create enough dye to, you know, color a beautiful piece of cloth, say like a piece of velvet or something. But as a result, because it was so expensive, it was only used for very precious textiles. Right. You know, you're not going to be taking this wonderful expensive dye and then using it to color any old bit of fabric. You want to color something really wonderful, like a rich piled velvet. And so you get this relationship between fabulous, sumptuous colours and fabulous, sumptuous textiles that are fit only for royalty.
So we see all these wonderful, wonderful pigments in the earth and in soot and in animals and shellfish, I know as well, that all these wonderful pigments. But then suddenly humans do chemistry, and they can just come up with synthetic colours. And I know the invention, there's a story you write about the invention of mauve, which is kind of one of those, a bit like kind of Alexander Fleming. He's sort of like, penicillin didn't exist, and then he woke up and looked in his petri dish and was like, oh look, that's interesting. And it's sort of one of those accidental stories that I can't believe is true, but perhaps you could tell it to us.
Yeah, so the story goes that William Henry Perkin was this sort of very young, budding chemist. He was 18 years old, and he was working in the spring holidays out of his father's attic. And he was actually not trying to make a colour at all. He wasn't interested in colour. What he actually really wanted to make was a cure for malaria. He wanted to make a synthetic version of quinine, which was a very useful, you know, very useful compound at the time. It could only be taken from trees, which wasn't very useful. But, you know, malaria was a huge problem for a country that had an enormous empire and sent troops and merchants all over the world. They wanted better sources of quinine. So he thought, you know, he was experimenting on coal tar to see if he could make quinine from coal tar.
Why? Okay, hang on, just pause that. There's a sort of leap there. Why would you go, okay, I need quinine, what have I got? Oh, coal tar. Like, why coal tar?
One of the reasons why coal tar was so exciting, I think there are a few reasons, there are lots of reasons, and a chemist would give you a different answer, but I believe that one of the reasons why it was so exciting is because there was so much of it about at that time. It was a kind of very cheap byproduct of the lighting that was being used at the time. There was an awful lot of it about. It was quite a complex substance, and chemists were really excited by it because you could create lots of different things with it, and it was believed to be this kind of wonder substance from which almost anything could be created.
Huh. Okay, so he thought, well, let's just check this out. So what did he do with the coal tar?
So he was basically messing around with it, doing various different experiments to try and create quinine, which is a colourless liquid. And he was in his father's attic one day during the spring holidays and found, to his slight disappointment, at the bottom of this test tube of coal tar that he was working on, he found a kind of sludgy, greyish purpley mush, which was not what he was after at all. And I think maybe another chemist might have just thrown this out, but he decided he was going to do a few more experiments on it. And what he ended up with was a beaker full of kind of a bright purple liquid. Again, not at all what he's after. And rather than just immediately throwing it away, he decides to play around with it a bit further. And one of the things that he does is he dips a piece of white cloth into this beaker, pulls it out, and the cloth is bright purple. And he realizes that this is quite significant. He realizes that he has created a dye, what seems to be a really great, color fast, bright dye. And not only that, it's purple. And purple dyes have got this incredible lineage. Tyrian purple, which is a purple that was made from mollusks, was the preeminent dye of the ancient world. It was beloved by the Phoenicians. It was beloved by the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans. And so having discovered a new source of what seems like a very vibrant, color fast, light resistant purple in his beaker by accident, he believes that he might have found something that is very commercially successful. Like I said, he's very young and quite naive. And I think that really helps because his initial approaches to the dye industry are not a success at all. The dye industry at the time is based on natural dyes, and they are not at all encouraging about a dye that is created in a lab by a young chemist. They're not really willing to try it out. But eventually he finds one dyer who will give it a go, and they're off. they've suddenly created the basis for the modern dye industry. And this, from this one dye, it will suddenly spring this whole family of colorants. You know, you get the purples, but then you get reds, you get greens, you get pinks, and you suddenly get this explosion of color just from his initial failed, quote unquote, experiments.
Well, that's my question is that once you've got a color, I mean, for example, if you want to make green, don't you, you just mix, what do you mix? Yellow and, I can't remember.
Yellow and blue.
Yellow and blue. Once you've got the idea of making synthetic dyes, presumably you can just make anything. You just mix different colours together and you can get the whole shebang.
Yes and no. So, you know, we had been able to make, for example, green by sort of dyeing a piece of cloth in first blue and then yellow, you know, well before the creation of synthetic dyes. We'd probably used, you know, indigo and weld. So indigo is the blue and weld is yellow. However, what you find is that the dyes react differently to light and to washing. So, you know, in the case of mixtures of weld and indigo, you expose them to light, the yellow dye kind of fades with light and what you're left with is blue. That's not what you want. You wanted green. So when you're creating new dyes, you're having to think a lot about the different conditions under which these things are going to be exposed and, you know, the expense and how well it adheres to different types of fibers. Because some dyes work very well with wool, for example, but don't work very well with silk. So you've got to think about how these dyes are going to be used, the kind of fabrics they're going to be used on. And this makes the kind of the process quite difficult, particularly when you're working with something like coal tar, which is quite reactive, and depending on the chemicals that you expose it to and the processes that you expose it to, can create this, like I said, this whole family of dyes, and that is wonderful, but comes with its own risks. You don't want it to be reacting with soap and then turning a whole different colour.
But can we say, I mean, 1856, William Perkin, can we in my quest to find the origins of things, can we sort of, he didn't obviously invent colour, but he sort of invented a kind of revolution in the way that suddenly all these dyes that were really expensive and rare, suddenly the fact that you could do it using chemistry must have changed everything, really.
It was a real step change. And because of his commercial success, although it took a few years and it took a couple of famous women wearing his particular mauve to make it a real commercial
success.
Which
famous women wore his mauve?
So most famously, probably Queen Victoria. So she wore a mauve dress to the wedding of one of her daughters. And this was reported on in the press. And as a result, mauve took off as the colour of the fashionable. And in fact, 1 or 2 years after she wore this dress, there was an article in Punch magazine saying that London had caught the mauve measles because so many people were wearing mauve.
You didn't see anyone wearing mauve anymore.
You saw no one wearing mauve before. But actually, mauve was a very difficult dye. And one of the dye stuffs that had been used before was lichen, you know, or lichens, you know, good sources of very vibrant purple dyes. There aren't that many of them. It's a difficult colour to create. But now you can create this artificial mauve, which is very bright. I mean, and I really do mean bright. If you look at kind of the original dyed samples of this kind of mauve silk, it's a very strident colour. And that was very exciting to the audience at the time, who might, if you weren't that well off previously, you might only have been able to get quite muddy colours. Well, now you've got this relatively cheap, inexpensive, very bright purple dye, which you can get your hands on for not that much money.
Who the hell comes up with the language, by the way? Who came up with the name mauve? It's like, okay, we've got this purple. Oh, we need another mauve. Like, if you find it, do you get to name it? Is it like a star or a crater on the moon or something?
Well, he did name it, but he initially, that was his kind of second choice of name. He initially wanted to call it Imperial Purple after the mollusk colour of the ancient world. But he changed his mind and decided to call it mauve, which is a French word, because obviously everything sounds better in French, but it's the French word for a flower that is a similar colour.
Oh, I didn't know that. There we go.
Fact.
That's a fact. That's a really good. And so suddenly we've got all these. So suddenly dyes and pigments become cheaper and more available. And just while we're on the subject of new colours, we're obsessed by black at the moment. And I've noticed you're wearing Vanta Black. So just, yes. Okay, I've done a whole podcast episode of Vanta Black, so I don't want to go too much into it. But essentially, they invent this new black that's the blackest black ever, and it absorbs 99.9999% of all the light. So it basically looks like you're looking into a kind of a black hole. It was Surrey Nanosystems developed it, and it's basically forests of carbon nanotubes that are sort of propagated onto a surface, and sort of light falls in it. And it really caught the
There's public imagination. I know it was designed originally for the space industry as coatings for satellites and that kind of stuff. But it sort of caught the public imagination. I suppose when Anish Kapoor, the artist, decided he wanted to use it and then sort of bought the rights to it, and everyone thought he was a prat. And then there was this kind of political backlash, this sort of anti-Anish Kapoor movement grew up out of it. But it's really weird how sort of political it got. And then other people invented even more blacker blacks than the blackest black ever.
Yeah,
it's an odd thing, isn't it?
It is an odd thing. And I think what I find so fascinating about the way that the story has developed with this kind of idea about rights and access to certain colours is that when you look back through history, because we are now able to get our hands on almost any colour that we want at the drop of a hat, you know, colour, we think of colour as being very democratic. But if you go back a few centuries, that wouldn't be the case. And artists had particular reputations. They developed particular reputations for their skill at producing certain colours, because they might layer certain pigments one on top of the other in a certain way that created a very special hue or shade or tone. And that became part of their craft. And they would be very secretive about how they did this. They might only pass it on to a few apprentices. They might not pass it on at all. And the idea that everyone should have access to colour is actually very, very new. And the skill at creating particular colours was, you know, has been part of art history.
Hey, maybe my Vanta Black sample is worth something.
Maybe. Maybe you shouldn't have mentioned it, because now you're going to get thieves coming into your house in the dead of night after your sample of Vanta Black.
I think I was meant to send it back, actually. They sent it to me because I needed to borrow it for something. I can't remember why.
I mean, borrowing does sound very different to giving.
Borrowing. I've got a little secret museum in my flat of like things I probably shouldn't have that I was meant to give back or not meant to have at all.
I hope you haven't got anything from Tutankhamun's tomb.
No. I've got nothing from Tutankhamun's tomb. Anyway, hey, listen, lovely to chat, Cassie. It's been a real pleasure. It's one of these stories and episodes I could just talk for all day about, because you've got so many different stories, but basically every colour, the entire colour wheel, you have got a story about. But we shall leave it there, I think. But thank you very much for dropping by.
Thank you very much for having me. It was great to talk about colours. I love doing it, and I could bore on for hours, so it's probably good that you've called a halt.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. I want to get you back on because I want to talk about clothes.
Perfect.
And the invention of, because I've got some thoughts on that. So we'll get you back on and talk about that if we can, and golden threads generally.
I would love that.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Hope you will have a new appreciation for the colours around you, the colours in your life. If you've enjoyed the show, don't forget to listen to other episodes. I hope you enjoy those too. Don't forget to tell your friends and family about the series. We count on your support and love hearing from you about that if you're enjoying it. And also don't forget, as ever, if you've got a suggestion for a topic or a story you'd like us to cover, you can email us at patented@historyhit.com, or you can just stop me in the street. See you next time.
Transitioning to a decarbonised economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organisation and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts, or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
While I still have you, very briefly, if you fancy getting all of the History Hit podcast archive and new episodes ad-free, along with hundreds of history documentaries to watch, download our app across Apple App Store, Google Play, and smart TV platforms. Follow the link in the show notes or go to historyhit.com/subscribe. There is thousands of hours of history on there, including a documentary on science in the Middle Ages with Seb Volk, and also one with me talking about the secret history of the space race. As a patented listener, you get a special gift if you use the code PATENTED at the checkout. You get 50% off your first 3 months. That's PATENTED for 50% off your first 3 months. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free podcast episodes within the Apple app.